Welcome to a very special presentation of the novel A Really Good Day by James Hosek. On its surface, it's a story about a remarkable round of golf. But if you're not a golfer, if you quickly change the channel, if you accidentally come upon a tournament on TV, I encourage you to listen anyway. It's a story about family and friendship. It's a story about redemption and second chances. It's a story about promises made and promises kept. It's a story about once-in-a-lifetime experiences. But most of all, it is one man's love letter to his family. That man was my brother, the author, James Hosek. Aside from being an amazing veterinarian, woodworker, gardener, husband, father, brother, son, and friend, he was a writer. Writers are often told to write what they know. And in this, his first book, he did that in more ways than I can count. It will make you laugh. It will make you cry. And it will make you stand up and cheer. So sit back and enjoy as Jim takes you on a fun, entertaining journey through 18 holes of golf and one man's really good day. Chapter 2. Driving Range.
"Where the blazes is my cameraman?" shouted Jason Bernard. His voice echoed through the parking garage of the USA Sports Channel Chicago offices. He had parked his green convertible near the row of white Ford E-150 vans that were used for remote taping and sometimes live broadcasts. He had called Ed Furley at dispatch from his cell phone on his way in and was expecting to have the van already warmed up. All he saw was a girl with a long red ponytail sitting on the bumper of a blue Honda Accord wearing a black leather jacket. He pulled out a cell phone and cursed the no-signal message flashing on the display.
"You Jason Bernard?"
asked the girl. "Who are you?" he replied, holding back none of his frustration.
"Ellen Burke. Call me Ellie. I'm your cameraman."
"You?" blurted Jason with disbelief.
"Yeah. You want to drive?"
she asked, launching from the bumper of the Honda towards one of the camera vans. "Drive? I don't even know where the place is."
"You never played George Done Me Wrong?"
"What?"
"The golf course. The Niagara tournament. Right? It's at George Dunn."
"I don't golf," answered Jason as he headed for the passenger side door. Ellie stopped in her tracks.
"You don't golf? What kind of sportscaster are you?"
"The unlucky kind, apparently," Jason muttered halfway under his breath.
"I can't believe you don't golf. Everybody golfs nowadays."
"Do you golf?"
"You bet. I'm not that good, but I still have a fun time. I love to watch tournaments. This is the first time I've ever covered one. Should be a blast. This guy, Andrew Patterson, is supposed to be pretty good. Destined for the PGA Tour. And he's a heck of a character."
"Just what I need. A golfer with an attitude."
"Shouldn't you be interested in all sports?"
asked Ellie as she pushed the unlock control on her remote keychain for the van. Jason opened his door, brushed some crumbs from his seat, slid in, and answered,
"I am interested in all legitimate sports."
"You have to be a real athlete to be good in this game," argued Ellie.
"I haven't seen so many pot bellies in one place since I stopped by the White Sox dugout last year."
"Dare you to put a fist in Tiger Woods' belly,"
she countered. "I just don't see the excitement in it," added Jason.
"Well, when I play, I find a challenge with every shot. And when I make that one great shot of the round that I never thought I had in me, I know I'll be back next week to try it again."
She started the van and backed up. "Maybe we can skip the end, get some tape on a few holes, a few comments from Patterson, and do some editing back at the studio. Hey, we could be done in time for lunch rather than dragging this out all day." Jason figured that would be enough effort to expend on this assignment, and getting home early would win him back some points with Sally.
"We might miss something exciting," argued Ellie.
"Somehow I seriously doubt that," answered Jason.
Here, I thought I lucked out by pulling this assignment.
Listen, Ellie, I should be covering the marathon. No one is going to care about some regional amateur golf championship in Chicago. This spot will be the first to be cut if something more interesting comes along. Get some tape of Patterson, quick interview, and voila, we're done. Okay?
Jeez, what a grouch.
Just work the camera, Ellie. I'll decide what we shoot.
Okay, Mr. Bernard. I just think...
warned Jason, not wanting to hear any suggestions that might ruin his plan for the day.
See if you can get any information on the radio about the marathon, would you?
You have to even out your brain, said the voice behind him.
Scott sighed and relaxed his grip on the club. He had been warming up at the driving range and just couldn't seem to find his perfect swing. A few shots went the way he wanted, but he knew he could do better. He turned to see who was offering the advice. An elderly man, still in pretty good physical shape, was leaning against the wall of the pro shop. He wore a maroon cardigan sweater over a knit golf shirt. A few strands of thinning gray hair sprayed out from the edges of a baseball cap, emblazoned with the Northern Illinois Amateur Golf Association logo.
You're thinking too much with one side of your brain. You're analyzing yourself too much and concentrating on the details rather than how the whole swing should feel.
How do I stop doing that?
Come here, he motioned.
Scott stepped over and shrugged.
Untie your left shoe.
What?
Untie it.
Scott was confused, but he thought he'd humor the guy for a little while. He leaned his driver against the club stand and untied the soft spike golf shoe on his left foot.
Good. Now tie it again.
What is this, some sort of philosophical lesson in life?
No, I want to demonstrate something, answered the man. When you tie it, cinch down the laces nice and tight. Make it noticeably uncomfortable, almost painful if you can.
Scott tilted his head with a confused expression, but resigned himself to following the instructions. He pulled on the laces until he could feel the sides of the shoe squeezing his foot and the laces biting across the top. He finished with a nice bow and stood up. The man walked over to Scott's bucket and pulled out one of the striped range balls. He placed it on the rubber practice tee, then handed Scott his club.
What's the farthest you've ever hit a drive?
A few inches over 300 yards, answered Scott honestly. No Tiger Woods, but not bad for an amateur.
Do you remember what it felt like? I don't mean the swing, but the sound of the ball hitting the club face perfectly. Then the ball taking off from the tee and slowly rising into the air, almost as if it had helium in it. It would never come down.
Scott chuckled. That was exactly what it had looked like.
Yeah, I do.
Don't think about the swing. Just the ball floating off the face of the earth.
He stepped back, out of the range of Scott's backswing.
Go ahead.
What the heck, thought Scott. Nothing else was working.
He set up his stance, standing about a yard from the ball. He gripped the end of the club with his left hand, then wrapped his right around the shaft right below it, his right pinky overlapping the left index finger. His thumbs pointed down the top of the shaft to the head of the driver. He lined up his feet and laid the club head on the mat. He rocked on his heels, setting his balance and letting his hands drop to a comfortable position in front of him. The picture of his ball lifting with an upward trajectory as it sailed out past the fence at the end of the range filled his mind. Wiggling his left foot a little, trying to adjust to the unusual tightness, he started his backswing. At the apex, he paused a fraction of a second before bringing the club around to meet the ball. He heard the precious plink as contact was made, and he let the club swing over his left shoulder as his eyes watched his ball sail with perfection. It rose and rose and rose.
Scott stood, mouth gaping open, as it landed by the 275-yard flag and continued to roll up to the fence at 300 yards. Range balls typically took 20 yards off a good drive. If he had been hitting one of his pinnacles, it might have made it 320 yards or more.
"Now, what was the last thing you remember before you swung?"
asked the man. "My stupid tight shoe."
"Not the mechanics of your swing? Not where your club should be, or keeping your arm straight, or remembering to bend your wrists?"
"No, my stupid shoe. Where the heck did that shot come from?"
"You stopped overpowering the right side of your brain with details and gave yourself over to the left half and let your natural ability take over."
"I can get almost anyone to swing like that, although I must admit it usually takes them 10 or 20 tries. You nailed it the first time around."
"So I just need to keep my left shoe tight?"
"No, that's just a way to interrupt your normal brain sequence. Once you feel it, it can return easily. Try again."
Scott placed another ball on the tee. Without a second thought, he started his backswing and watched a second ball follow almost the same trajectory as the last. He turned around, grinning. "Who are you?"
"Oh, sorry," apologized the elderly man. "Ted Ling. The tournament hired me to help out anyone who might need a quick lesson at the driving range."
He extended his right hand and Scott shook it. "Scott Hanover."
"I know. I saw you play 2 weeks ago at Indian Boundary. That shot on the last hole was amazing. You knew you nailed that 50-foot putt as soon as you hit the ball."
"It was a lucky shot."
"Perhaps," answered Ted. "But luck isn't a bad thing."
"I suppose not. So, Ted, you're helping everyone hit like that?"
"No, most people are too set in their ways, especially at this level, to want to make any changes."
"Well, I'm not at this level."
"You're close.
You were at that tournament. I only made second because of a disqualification, and I'm only here today because some guy broke his wrist. I'm a real fish out of water around here. I just hope I don't embarrass myself around these other guys today."
"You know what really separates them from you, Scott?"
$3,000 in golf equipment?
"Well, there is that," laughed Ted. "But it's how you approach the game. You're not here to keep from embarrassing yourself, but to have a fun time. If you don't do well, you go home. Look forward to the next time you go out, and maybe do a little better. You play against yourself."
Ted leaned a little closer to finish his thought.
"To most of these guys, this is a make-or-break tournament, a chance to play with the pros. If they flub a shot, they'll think about it for years. They'll beat themselves up the rest of the game and spiral into a real mess."
"I can do that without the pressure of a tournament," joked Scott.
"I suppose you can," laughed Ted. "But those guys let the game play them, rather than playing the game. It's become a job for them. They've stopped loving it. You still love to be out there, no matter how well you play."
"Still, I don't really have a shot. Most of these guys shoot well under par."
"Not all the time," corrected Ted. "I bet if you took their top 18 worst holes over the last year, they'd be shooting 120-something.
Scott laughed. "Yeah, I suppose."
"Tell me, Scott, have you ever had a birdie?"
"Yeah, lots of times."
"More than 18?
"I hope so."
"Ever make an eagle?"
"Once. Nailed a chip shot on a par 5.
"Okay. We take your best holes and put them together, and you can shoot a 53.
Scott laughed heartily at the possibility. "You have me there, Ted."
"You said you had a lucky putt 2 weeks ago. Imagine if you put together 50-some lucky shots in a row."
"That'd be like rolling snake eyes 50 times in a row. The odds against it are astronomical."
"But the chances aren't zero."
Ted started another tack.
You know about the bell curve?
Sure.
Well, if you plot out all of your scores, they would group around your average. Most clustered in the middle, but a few high scores and low scores spread out at the edges. Fewer the farther you get from your average.
Right.
Well, statisticians can calculate the percentage of scores that will happen at any particular point. Heck, there's even a small chance someone could score a 36 on any particular course. What I'm trying to say is that if you play long enough, you're bound to put together a real good game at some point, just like you have real lousy games occasionally.
I don't think I've played long enough, added Scott.
Just like rolling 50 snake eyes in a roll with the dice, the odds that you do it the first time out are the same as the millionth time.
So today could be my day to shoot a 36.
Now Ted laughed.
Maybe. But just imagine having 18 of your best holes, an eagle, maybe a few pars. Heck, even with a bogey or two, you would be more than competitive with these guys.
That'd be nice.
All I'm saying is that it's possible. Just keep your brain even and have fun.
That I can do, Ted.
I must say, it's been very nice to meet you. You've taken the edge off today for me. I think I'll have a good time.
Ted shook Scott's hand firmly. Looking down at Scott's left foot, he said,
"Better loosen that lace up before you lose circulation."
Scott chuckled again.
"Oh, and Scott, have a really good day."
"I will," said Scott. He replayed his last two drives in his head and thought to himself again, "I will."
"Sorry I'm late,"
shouted Paul Bauer as he came jogging up the driving range. He clapped a friendly hand onto Scott's shoulder. Even after the jog, Paul wasn't out of breath. His brown hair was cropped to its usual buzz cut, his beard and mustache trimmed to a neat Van Dyke.
"Hey, I just saw some guy nail a drive all the way to the fence."
"That was me," said Scott.
Paul froze in his tracks.
"You're kidding."
Rather than answering, Scott placed a ball on the tee and whacked it with confidence. It sailed almost as far as his first drive with Ted's instruction. He turned back to find Paul staring with his jaw hanging open.
"I've been able to knock out at least half of them that far, none shorter than 250 yards, and that's with these cruddy range balls. I still don't have full control of the direction, but hey, on the drive, I don't have to be that accurate."
"What did you do? Sell your soul?"
"That guy over there gave me a quick lesson." Scott pointed to Ted Lang, who was now giving pointers to another golfer on the range.
"That's Ted Lang," said Paul.
"You know him?"
"He was on the senior tour a while back. I saw him at the local tournament 2 weeks ago when you sank that putt. I heard he hurt his back a while ago and had to quit the tour."
"Nice guy," commented Scott.
"So what exactly did he tell you?"
"To tie my shoe," laughed Scott.
He explained the whole encounter to Paul and how he had spent the last 10 minutes practicing his drive with the new mental technique. He was starting to get grooved into his swing. If only he had figured it out a month ago, he'd feel a lot better.
"Well, you're going to be up soon. You're in the first threesome to go off."
"You mean I placed that low in the standings?"
60th out of 60 is as low as you can get, Scott.
Tournaments that did not use a shotgun start usually had the poorest players first. That way, the real battles for the title would play out later in the day.
"Who am I golfing with?" asked Scott.
"Jerry Spalding and Pete Baldwin.
I don't know either of them, but they both have single-digit handicaps."
Paul was close to being in that league. If he hadn't blown a hole in his own local tournament, Scott might be caddying for him.
Thankfully, Paul seemed not to harbor any ill will concerning the twist of fate. He was pulling for Scott and was impressed by the drives he was seeing now. Paul Bauer was a fairly good athlete during high school and college. Baseball, bowling, golf, even a little bicycle racing. He had a natural ability to pick up a sport and become good at it. Sometimes really good.
The two had been friends since grade school and made an effort to get together on weekends for a round whenever they could. Since Paul's two kids had started school, he had been out golfing more, but prior to that, he was not out all that often. Scott knew a similar fate faced him once his first child was born in a couple of weeks. He really hoped to take home some good memories, and hopefully not finish dead last, as his handicap predicted. Scott unfastened the Velcro on the glove from his left hand and handed his driver to Paul. Paul smiled and took it. His job as a caddy had just officially started. Unofficially, he had taken some time last week to walk the course, checking out the fairways and greens, measuring some distances, and making a few notes to help them along. Paul stopped as they exited the practice area and set Scott's golf bag down. "I have something for you," he said as he pulled a black golf glove and a pack of green tees from his pocket and handed them to Scott. "I had hoped Zorro could make an appearance in the tournament today, but maybe you'll do the honor of using these?" Zorro was Scott's nickname for Paul when he was on a particular hot streak on the course, due to the black golf glove he always wore. The green tees were another part of his signature golf equipment. Paul preferred the color green as a psychological ploy to help his game. The ploy, however, was aimed at his golf ball, not him. He believed that if a ball was sitting on a green tee, it would think it was just sitting on the grass and wouldn't be worried that a club head was about to smash into it at over 100 miles an hour, squashing it flat like a pancake, then allowing it to explode from its face with a burst of energy. "I also had a few of these made up," added Paul. He pulled a sleeve of golf balls from his other pocket and handed them to Scott. Scott looked a little confused. "Open the box, stupid," instructed his friend. Scott laughed when he saw what Paul had done. Each of the balls was imprinted with a custom logo, a large yellow rubber duck with an orange beak, orange webbed feet, and a silly grin was stamped over the Pinnacle logo. Duck was Paul's nickname for Scott because he had a tendency to hit balls into the water. "Quack, quack," uttered Scott with a laugh. "I got three more sleeves in the car. That should hold you for 18, I hope." Scott put his right arm over Paul's shoulder as they headed for the starters table. If nothing else, it would be a fun day. Jake pulled into the parking lot of the George W. Dunn National Golf Course next to a USA Sports camera van. Must be a bigger deal than he thought if they were going to be covering the tournament. Couldn't hurt to have some tape of Patterson running on the 10 o'clock news to run up the golfer's stock a little. His Geo Metro sputtered into the space and died before he had a chance to shut it off. A new car would be first on his list of priorities after he received his commission. He'd be able to pay off all his debts, start things over, make up a lot to Gina. He stared at the steering wheel for a good long time and considered doubling back to the liquor store on 159th Street for a six-pack of Budweiser. He knew he could function well on a couple of beers, and it would sure help take the edge off today and the doubts he was feeling. His earlier confidence was sputtering. He slumped back in his seat, his fingers tightly grasped around the steering wheel. He glanced at the rearview mirror and adjusted it to reveal his reflection. 3 Advil had reduced most of the pounding in his brain to a dull throb, but his face still showed the effects of a year of abuse. He hadn't been able to find a totally clean set of clothes and settled for the least stained, least wrinkled shirt on his bedroom floor. A wide tie covered some of the spots, and a tweed sports coat hid the rest. His brown slacks also needed a good laundering, but he settled for letting them steam while he took his shower. Gray strands had started to salt his hair, which had retreated up his forehead nearly an inch in the last year. He needed a haircut, maybe even a teeth whitening. Time for those things later. He took a deep breath and found himself staring at a corner of what looked like a white card sticking out from above the passenger side visor. He reached over for it and pulled it out. It was a photograph. a picture of him and Brad Finley in London, taken right before the accident. Brad was giving the thumbs up with his left hand and had his right hanging over Jake's shoulder. Why had he put that photo there? He didn't remember doing it. He found himself wondering what had happened to Brad. Neither Brad nor his family had reached out to him after the accident, and Jake had made no effort to find out for himself. Brad Finley had put his life in Jake's hands, and Jake had failed him, not only as an agent, but also as a friend. As sobriety dusted away the cobwebs of his brain, his shortcomings came back to the forefront, and he began to realize what an utter jerk he had become over the last year. Even he didn't like himself all that much anymore. The thought of drinking a beer suddenly became revolting to him. Whatever his reasons for putting the picture there in the first place, its effect had been to put his life in perspective. He was getting a second chance today. Hopefully, he would start a string of second chances. He opened the door, stepped out of the car, and took a breath of fresh air. 12 hours without a cigarette, the longest he had gone in 15 years. Already he could smell things that until now had been buried deep in his memory. The fresh-cut grass of the golf course was the first thing he noticed. The pull of the hot coffee brewing at the starter's table was next. A cup of coffee would certainly help shake the morning dew off his brain. He glanced toward the practice range to his right. Although he couldn't see who hit it, a shot sailed just 20 yards short of the far fence and bounced to a stop next to it. Jake wasn't a golfer, but he knew the game, and he knew that was a decent drive. He hoped to see whoever hit it playing on the course. Maybe it was even Andrew Patterson.
"Name?" asked the man, staring at a clipboard at the starter's table, as Andrew Patterson stepped up to sign in. The official wore a red jacket with the Northern Illinois Amateur Golf Association patch stitched on the left breast pocket. A plastic laminated name tag was pinned to the lapel.
"Patterson," said Andrew.
The man scanned his roster, found Andrew's name at the end, and made a heavy X next to it.
"You're in the last group. You tee off in about two..."
He stopped in mid-sentence as he looked up to hand Andrew his player's envelope. He gathered himself after digesting Andrew's appearance and continued,
"Hours."
He held up the clipboard for Andrew.
"Sign here,"
he instructed. Andrew was unfazed by the stares he received. His outfit was acceptable golfing attire, if perhaps a century out of style. But he liked it, and that was all that mattered. He signed in, smiled, and walked away. A few chuckles and whispered comments followed him. In the envelope, he found a paper number for his caddy, Eric Peters, to pin to his back as they traversed the course today. Eric had caddied for Andrew before and had adequately met Andrew's needs. Mainly, someone to carry his bag and stay quiet. He glanced around to see if Eric had arrived yet. A smile creased his lips as he noticed a familiar figure nearby. Standing 50 feet away with his left arm in a cast, held up by a blue sling, was Joe Calkin. The broken arm was the reason why Andrew was so confident this tournament was his to win. Joe shook his head when he saw Patterson approaching. Undoubtedly, the man was coming over to express his insincere condolences for Joe's misfortune. Joe was 35 years old. He was physically fit, 6 feet and 190 pounds. His blonde hair curled loosely around his head, and his bright blue eyes almost matched the fall sky. He had taken a sabbatical from his job as a physical education instructor at Northeastern University to work on his golf game. He hoped someday to go pro, perhaps not until he was eligible for the senior circuit, but he wanted a taste of the big time. His accident couldn't have come at a worse time. He knew the second the log fell on his wrist that the bone had broken. He had broken the same wrist in high school and remembered the feeling and the pain.
tough break, joked Andrew.
Lucky break for you, answered Joe.
Well, your time will come, Joe, Andrew said, smirking.
You know, you don't necessarily have this one yet. Anything can happen. Ask David Duval, sitting in a sand trap on 17 for 5 shots.
I always play it safe. That's why I win, Joe. In fact, if you want to take the field against me in a little wager, I wouldn't oppose a little friendly action.
The whole field? Asked Joe.
Why not? I'll have it in the bag by 15, no matter what.
Shall we say $1,000? Asked Joe.
Why not 5? Retorted Andrew.
I thought you wanted to keep it friendly.
If you're too afraid.
You know you're a jerk, Patterson.
I can live with that, Andrew answered.
You may have the technical aspect of the game mastered, but there is more to this game than hitting a ball with precision. You haven't learned that part yet. These other guys may not be as skillful as you are, but they have the heart to be a winner, and sometimes that's all it takes.
He reached out his right hand to seal the deal.
$5,000 it is.
Andrew took Joe's good hand and shook, trying not to grimace at Joe's vice-like grip.
Just bring your checkbook to the clubhouse after the 18th, said Andrew.
He glanced toward the clubhouse and spotted his quarry that had been his aim before Culkin distracted him. A medium-height, blond-haired boy was staring out over the first hole, his hands in his pockets, as he took in the view.
Eric, shouted Andrew Patterson as he stopped over to his waiting caddy.
Joe chuckled and flexed the fingers of his left hand. There was hardly any pain now. The doctor said the fracture was non-displaced, and Joe had begged for a removable splint so he could still try to play. His wife had joined the orthopedist in convincing him that another day and another tournament awaited him. Today he would hope that pompous jerk Patterson would get a taste of the Muse. The Muse was Joe's name for the fickle golf god that afflicted his life. Perhaps goddess was a more accurate term, for no one other than a woman could tease a golfer so much. A sudden gust of wind here and a chipmunk hole there could destroy an otherwise perfect shot. Of course, it worked both ways. A poorly hit chip shot could strike the pin and fall into the hole with awe-inspiring perfection. A drive slicing into the woods could bounce off a tree and land smack in the middle of the fairway with a clear shot to the green. Andrew Patterson was technically one of the best golfers Joe had seen in a while, but he seemed to lack any humility. Joe had played against Patterson twice and lost both times. Patterson seemed intolerant of other people's mistakes and never seemed to make mistakes himself. Joe was hoping for the Muse to intervene today. He had $5,000 riding on her.
Is it bad? Asked a female voice from his left.
Joe turned to see a smiling, red-haired girl with a video camera riding on her right shoulder.
Is what bad?
Your wrist.
Oh, that, realized Joe.
You're Joe Culkin, right?
Yeah.
She gestured to a well-groomed man with a sports coat and tie a couple yards behind her.
We're here to cover the tournament. Anything to say about the game today?
Sure,
he answered. Ellie introduced herself and Jason. Jason shook his hand and smiled, saying nothing.
He's a little crabby, commented Ellie.
She turned to Jason. Do you want to ask Joe some questions? He was supposed to be in the tournament today.
What for? Asked Jason.
Background, color, human interest, she suggested. Or I can do it.
Whatever, said Jason.
She handed Joe a small microphone that was attached by a long cord to her camera. He clipped it to his jacket. She hefted the camera up so that she was looking in the eyepiece and smiled.
Tell me, Joe, who do you think is going to win today?
Jason shook his head. What a waste of time.
Well, started Joe, many favor Andrew Patterson, since I won't be swinging any clubs today. But all these guys are top amateurs. They wouldn't be this far if they weren't.
So you think Patterson can do it?
Well, someone is going to have a pretty good day to beat him, or he's going to have to run into some bad luck.
I guess anything's possible, she added.
You bet. For example, the guy taking my spot is playing today, not only because of my clumsiness, he explained, lifting his cast for emphasis, but because he put together a pretty good game, and the second place finisher was disqualified. All it takes is a twist of fate for the unexpected to happen.
Who is taking your place?
Scott Hanover.
So you think he can beat Patterson?
Joe laughed. That would be a miracle. I checked the standings, and it seems he's ranked last out of all the golfers playing today.
Well, maybe someone else can give Patterson a run for his money.
That's what I'm hoping, said Joe. Ted Lang might have some ideas who to watch today.
Ted Lang is here? She asked, letting her camera drop.
Jason had to interrupt. Are you done with this spot? He asked.
I'm done, Mr. Bernard, Ellie answered.
Ted's at the driving range, helping the golfers work out any last-minute problems.
We should talk to him, suggested Ellie. He was on the senior tour. He'd have a good idea whom to watch. She pointed over to the practice area. The driving range is over there.
Jason looked out across the parking lot to an area fenced on the back and right sides, with a line of tall pines on the left. Tiny white balls were sailing from unseen practice mats with an irregular rhythm. I'm not walking all the way over there, he complained. I'll be in the clubhouse. Talk to him yourself if you want. I'm going to find myself a cup of coffee.
What a great idea, agreed Ellie. I'll take my black 2 sugars.
Before he could open his mouth to give a sarcastic reply, she was bouncing down the sidewalk to the driving range with the camera and her shoulder bag. I would have to get a nutty camera woman, he thought.
He decided to get her the coffee.
She was, after all, doing most of the work, and he decided it would be to his advantage to keep her happy. If she shot a lot of footage now, maybe she wouldn't complain too much if they left early. Ted was excited to have the pretty red-haired girl set up her camera to interview him. It brought back the old days when he was on tour, and those were good times.
So, Ellie started, I know Andrew Patterson is the favorite, but who else looks good to win?
Well, on paper, one has to assume Patterson could easily take the win today.
How about off paper? Suggested Ellie.
Statistically, any of these guys has a chance.
Even Scott Hanover?
Ted chuckled.
Yeah, even him. How do you know about Mr. Hanover?
Joe Culkin explained that his accident was the reason Hanover was playing today.
Well, Scott Hanover has an advantage that few of these top amateurs can claim.
What's that?
When I saw him play 2 weeks ago, I had the sense that he wasn't on the course to compete against any of the other golfers there that day, but to play against himself, trying to hit the ball a little straighter and farther with every shot, happy with the good shots and determined not to repeat the bad ones. A golfer like that is bound to have a good day every once in a while. He's in a different place than most of these guys. They want to win. He wants to play.
Interesting assessment, Mr. Lang.
Call me Ted.
Ellie let down her camera and shook the old golfer's hand.
Thanks for the interview. You going to watch the round?
I'll be here until just before the last group tees off, so I should see most of the tournament.
Well, have a good day, said Ellie. She turned and started walking back up to the clubhouse.
Despite having to work with a sportscaster who seemed to hate golf, she was determined to do a thorough job today. One never knew when a bit of tape would come in handy, and she brought a lot today. The chill of the morning still seemed to cling to the day, despite the rising sun. She hoped Jason Bernard had her coffee.
Thank you for listening to A Really Good Day, a novel by James Hosek, narrated by Rich Hosek.
If you're interested in purchasing a hardcover edition of this story for yourself or a golfer in your life, visit jimbooks.myshopify.com. You'll get free shipping in the United States. You'll also get the complete audiobook and ebook editions with your purchase. And make sure to subscribe to the mailing list for updates about the upcoming release of his Doctor at Mystery series, Cozy Mysteries About a Crime-Solving Veterinarian. Thanks again, and all the very best.